A few days earlier, continued.
Promote him, said Basil. The games you play, I swear I cannot keep up with them. The man's a traitor, he should be arrested and shot.
But his anguish moved no one on the panel that sat before him in the Prime Minister's murky staff room.
Basil, so it should be with men of action, but you posit a world where things are clear and simple, said Sir Colin. Such a planet does not exist. On this one, the real one, direct action is almost always impossible. Thus one must move on the oblique, making concessions and allowances all the way, never giving up too much for too little, tracking reverberations and rebounds, keeping the upper lip as stiff as if embalmed with concrete. Thus we leave small creatures, such as our wretch of a Cambridge librarian, alone in hopes of influencing someone vastly more powerful. Professor, perhaps you could put Basil in the picture so he understands what it is we are trying to do, and why it is so bloody important.
It's called Operation Citadel, said Professor Turing. The German staff has been working on it for some time now. Even though we would like to think that the mess they engineered on themselves at Stalingrad ended it for them, that is mere wishful dreaming. They are wounded, but still immensely powerful.
Professor, you speak as if you had a seat in the OKW General Office's mess.
In a sense, he does. The professor mentioned the little machines he builds, how they are able to try millions of possibilities and come up with solutions to the German code combinations and produce reasonable decryptions. Thus we have indeed been able to read Jerry's mail. Frankly, I know more about German plans than about what is happening two doors down in my own agency, what the Americans are doing or who the Russians have sent to Cambridge. But it's a gift that must be used sagely. If it's used sloppily, it will give up the game and Jerry will change everything. So we just use a bit of it now and then. This is one of those nows or thens. Go on, Professor.
I defer to a strategic authority.
General Cavendish?
Cavendish, the Army General, had a face that showed emotions from A all the way to A minus. It was a mask of meat shaped in an oval and built bluntly around two ball bearings empty of light, wisdom, empathy, or kindness, registering only force. He had about a pound of nose in the center of it and a pound of medals on his tunic.
Operation Citadel, he delivered as rote fact, not interpretation, is envisioned as the Goethe Dammerung of the war in the East, the last titanic breakthrough that will destroy the Russian war-making effort and bring the Soviets to the German table, hats in hand. At the very least, if it's successful, as most think it will be, it'll prolong the war by another year or two. We had hoped to see the fighting stop in 1945. Now it may well last into 1947, and many more millions of men may die. And I should point out that a good number of those additional millions will be German. So we are trying to win, yes indeed, but we are trying to do so swiftly, so that the dying can stop. That is what is at stake, you see.
And that is why you cannot crush this little Cambridge rat's arse under a lorry. All right, I see that, I suppose, annoyed at it though I remain.
Citadel, slated for May, probably cannot happen until July or August, given the logistics. It is to take place in southwest Russia, several hundred miles to the west of Stalingrad. At that point, around a city called Kursk, the Russians find themselves with a bulge in their lines. A salient, if you will. Secretly, the Germans have begun massing material both above and beneath the bulge. When they believe they have overwhelming superiority, they will strike. They will drive north from below and south from above, behind walls of tigers, flocks of Stukas, and thousands of artillery pieces. The infantry will advance behind the tanks. When the encirclement is complete, they will turn and kill the 300,000 men in the center and destroy the 50,000 tanks. The morale of the Red Army will be shattered, the loss is so overwhelming that all the American aid in the world cannot keep up with it. And the Russians will fall back, back, back to the Urals. Leningrad will fall, then Moscow. The war will go on and on and on.
I'm no genius,
said Basil.
But even I can figure it out. You must tell Stalin. Tell him to fortify and resupply that bulge. Then, when the Germans attack, they will fail, and it is they who will be on the run. The war will end in 1945, and those millions of lives will have been saved. Plus, I can then drink myself to death uninterrupted as I desire.
Again, sir,
said the Admiral, who was turning out to be Basil's most ardent admirer.
He has seen the gist of it straight through.
There is only one thing, Basil, said Sir Colin. We have told Stalin. He doesn't believe us.
The third day.
Yasta 3 at Vrain, late 1916, said Macht. Albatross, a barge to fly.
He was an ace, said Abel. Drop a hat and he'd tell you about it.
Old comrade, said Oberst Gunther Scholl. Yes, I was Yasta 7 at Roulers. That was in 1917. God, so long ago.
Old chaps, said Abel, now the nostalgia is finished, so perhaps we can get on with our real task, which is staying out of Russia.
Volta will never go to Russia, said Macht. Family connections. He'll stay in Paris, and when the Americans come, he'll join up with them. He'll finish the war a lieutenant colonel in the American army, but he does have a point.
Didi, that's the first compliment you ever gave me, if only you meant it. But one can't have everything.
So let's go through this again, Herr Oberst, said Macht to Colonel Scholl. Volta reminds us that there's a very annoyed SS officer stomping around out there, and he would like to send you to the Russian front. He would like to send all of us to the Russian front except Volta. So it is now imperative that we catch the fellow you sat next to for 6 hours, and you must do better at remembering.
The hour was late, or early, depending. Oberst Scholl had imagined himself dancing the night away at Maxim's with Hilda, then retiring to a dawn of love at the Ritz. Instead, he was in a dingy room on the Rue Guy de Maupassant, being grilled by gumshoes from the slums of Germany in an atmosphere seething with desperation, sour smoke, and cold coffee.
Hauptmann Macht, believe me, I wish to avoid the Russian front at all costs. Brickbeck is no prize, and command of a night fighter squadron does not suggest, I realize, that I am expected to do big things in the Luftwaffe. But I am happy to fight my war there and surrender when the Americans arrive. I have told you everything.
This I do not understand, said Lieutenant Abel. You had previously met Monsieur Pierre, and you thought this fellow was he? Yet the photography shows a face quite different from the one I saw at the Montparnasse station.
Still, they are close, explained the colonel somewhat testily. I had met Pierre at a reception put together by the Vichy mayor of Brickbeck, between senior German officers and prominent sympathetic businessmen. This fellow owned 2 restaurants and a hotel, was a power behind the throne, so to speak, and we had a brief but pleasant conversation. I cannot say I memorized his face, as why would I? When I got to the station, I glanced at the registration of French travelers and saw Pien's name and thus looked for him. I suppose I could say it was my duty to amuse our French sympathizers, but the truth is, I thought I could charm my way into a significant discount at his restaurants or pick up a bottle of wine as a gift. That is why I looked for him. He did seem different, but I ascribed that to the fact that he now had no moustache. I teased him about it, and he gave me a story about his wife's dry skin.
The 2 policemen waited for more, but there wasn't any more.
I tell you, he spoke French perfectly, no trace of an accent, and was utterly calm and collected. In fact, that probably was a giveaway I missed. Most French are nervous in German presence, but this fellow was quite wonderful.
What did you talk about for 6 hours?
I run on about myself, I know, and so with a captive audience, that is what I did. My wife kicks me when I do so inappropriately, but unfortunately she was not there.
So he knows all about you, but we know nothing about him.
That is so, said the Oberst. Unfortunately.
I hope you speak Russian as well as French, said Abel, because I have to write a report, and I'm certainly not going to put the blame on myself.
All right, said Scholl. Here is one little present. Small, I know, but perhaps just enough to keep me out of a Stuka cockpit.
They're all ears.
As I have told you many times, he rode in the cab to the Ritz, and when we arrived, I left and he stayed in the cab. I don't know where he took it, but I do remember the cabbie's name. They must display their licenses on the dashboard. It was Philippe Amois. Does that help?
It did. That afternoon, Macht stood before a squad room filled with about 50 men, a third his own, a third from Feldpolizei Battalion 11, and a third from Bock's SS detachment, all in plain clothes. Along with Abel, the Feldpolizei sergeant, and Hauptsturmführer Bock, he sat at the front of the room. Behind was a large map of Paris. Even Bock had dressed down for the occasion, though to him down was a bespoke pinstriped double-breasted black suit.
All right, he said. Long night ahead, boys. Get used to it now. We think we have a British agent hiding somewhere here.
And he pointed at the 5th arrondissement, the left bank, the absolute heart of cultural and intellectual Paris.
That is the area where a cab driver left him early this morning, and I believe Hauptsturmführer Bock's interrogators can speak to the truthfulness of the cab driver.
Bock nodded, knowing that his interrogation techniques were not widely approved of.
The Louvre and Notre Dame are right across the river. The Institut de France dominates the skyline on this site, and on the hundreds of streets are small hotels and restaurants, cafes, various retail outlets, apartment buildings, and so forth and so on. It is a catacomb of possibilities entirely too immense for a dragnet or a mass cordon and search effort. Instead, each of you will patrol a block or so. You are on the lookout for a man of medium height, reddish to brownish hair, squarish face. More recognizably, he is a man of what one might call charisma. Not beauty, per se, but a kind of inner glow that attracts people to him, allowing him to manipulate them. He speaks French perfectly, possibly German as well. He may be in any wardrobe, from shabby French clerk to priest, even to a woman's dress. If confronted, he will offer well-thought-out words, be charming, agreeable, and slippery. His papers don't mean much. He seems to have a sneak thief's skills at picking pockets, so he may have traded off several identities by the time you get to him. The best tip I can give you is this. If you see a man and think what a great friend he'd be, he's probably the spy. His charm is his armor and his principal weapon. He is very clever, very dedicated, very intent on his mission. Probably armed and dangerous as well, but please be forewarned. Taken alive, he will be a treasure trove. Dead, he's just another Brit body.
Sir, are we to check hotels for new registrations?
No. Uniformed officers have that task. This fellow, however, is way too clever for that. He'll go to ground in some anonymous way, and we'll never find him by knocking on hotel room doors. Our best chance is when he is out on the street. Tomorrow will be better, as a courier is bringing the real Monsieur Piancy's photo up from Briquebec, and our artist will remove the moustache and thin the face, so we should have a fair likeness. At the same time, I and all my detectives will work our phone contacts and listen for any gossip, rumours, and reports of minor incidents that might reveal the fellow's presence. We will have radio cars stationed every few blocks, so you can run to them and reach us if necessary, and thus we can get reinforcements to you quickly, if that need develops. We can do no more. We are the cat, he is the mouse. He must come out for his cheese.
If I may speak, said Hauptsturmführer Bock.
Who could stop him?
and thus he delivered a 30-minute tirade that seemed modeled after Hitler's speech at Nuremberg, full of threats and exotic metaphors and fueled by pulsing anger at the world for its injustices, perhaps mainly in not recognizing the genius of Bach. All of it well punctuated by the regrettable fact that those who gave him evidence of shirking or laziness could easily end up on that cold anti-tank gun in Russia, facing the Mongol hordes. It was not well received. Of course, Basil was too foxy to bumble into a hotel. Instead, his first act on being deposited on the left bank well after midnight was to retreat to the alleyways of more prosperous blocks and look for padlocked doors to the garages. It was his belief that if a garage was padlocked, it meant the owners of the house had fled for more hospitable climes, and he could safely use such a place for his hideout. He did this rather easily, picking the padlock and slipping into a large vault of a room occupied by a Rolls-Royce Phantom on blocks, clear evidence that its wealthy owners were now rusticating safely in Beverly Hills in the United States. His first order of the day was rest. He had, after all, been going full steam for 48 hours now, including his parachute arrival in France, his exhausting ordeal by Luftwaffe Oberst on the long train ride, and his miraculous escape from Montparnasse Station, also courtesy of the Luftwaffe Oberst, whose name he did not even know. The limousine was open. He crawled into a back seat that had once sustained the arses of a prominent industrialist, a department store magnate, the owner of a chain of jewelry stores, a famous whore, whatever, and quickly went to sleep. He awoke at 3 in the afternoon and had a moment of confusion. Where was he? In a car. Why? Oh, yes, on a mission. What was that mission? Funny, it seemed so important at one time. Now he could not remember it. Oh, yes, the path to Jesus. There seemed no point in going out by day, so he examined the house from the garage, determined that it was deserted, and slipped into it, entering easily enough. It was a ghostly museum of the aristocratic Duclercs, who'd left their furniture under sheets and their larder empty, and by now dust had accumulated everywhere. He amused himself with a little prowl, not bothering to go through drawers, for he was a thief only in the name of duty. He did borrow a book from the library and spent the evening in the cellar, reading it by candlelight. It was Tolstoy's great War and Peace, and he got more than 300 pages into it. He awakened before dawn. He tried his best to make himself presentable and slipped out, locking the padlock behind himself. The early morning streets were surprisingly well populated, as working men hastened to a first meal and then a day at the job. He melded easily, another anonymous French clerk with a day-old scrub of beard and a somewhat dowdy dark suit under a dark overcoat. He found a café and had a café au lait and a large piece of buttered toast, sitting in the rear as the place filled up. He listened to the gossips and quickly picked up that les boss were everywhere today. No one had seen them out in such force before. It seemed that most were plainclothesmen simply standing around or walking a small patrol beat. They performed no services other than looking at people, so it was clear that they were on some sort of stakeout duty. Perhaps a prominent resistance figure. This brought a laugh, always, as most regarded the resistance as a joke. Had come in for a meet-up with Sartre at Les Deux Magots. Or a British agent was here to assassinate Dietrich von Kotitz, the garrison commander of Paris, and a man as objectionable as a summer moth. But everyone knew the British weren't big on killing, as it was the Czechs who'd bumped off Heydrich. After a few hours, Basil went for his reconnaissance. He saw them almost immediately, chalk-faced men wearing either the tight faces of hunters or the slack faces of time-servers. Of the two, he chose the latter, since a loafer was less apt to pay attention and wouldn't notice things and, furthermore, would go off duty exactly when his shift was over. The man stood, shifting weight from one foot to the other, blowing into his hands to keep them warm, occasionally rubbing the small of his back where strain accumulated when he who does not stand or move much suddenly has to stand and move. It was time to hunt the hunters. A few days ago, continued.
It's the trust issue again, said General Cavendish, in a tone suggesting he was addressing the scullery mice. In his rat-infested brain, the fellow still believes the war might be a trap, meant to destroy Russia and communism. He thinks that we may be feeding him information on Operation Citadel, about this attack on the Kursk salient, as a way of manipulating him into overcommitting to defending against that attack. He wastes men, equipment, and treasure building up the Kursk bulge on our say-so. Then come July, Hitler's panzer troops make a feint in that direction, but drive en masse into some area of the line that has been weakened because all the troops have been moved down to the Kursk bulge. Hitler breaks through, envelops, takes and raises Moscow, then pivots, heavy with triumph, to deal with the moribund Kursk salient. Why, he needn't even attack. He can do to those men what was done to Paulus's 6th Army at Stalingrad, simply shell and starve them into submission. At that point, the war in the East is over, and communism is destroyed.
I see where you're going with this, gentlemen, said Basil. We must convince Stalin that we are telling the truth. We must verify the authenticity of Operation Citadel so that he believes in it and acts accordingly. If he doesn't, Operation Citadel will succeed. Those 300,000 men will die, and the war will continue for another year or two. The soldiers now say home alive in 45, but the bloody reality will be dead in heaven in 47. Yet more millions will die. We cannot allow that to happen.
Do you see it yet, Basil? Said Sir Colin. It would be so helpful if you saw it for yourself, if you realized what has to be done. That no matter how long the shot, we have to play it, because yours is the part that depends on faith. Only faith will get you through the ordeal that lies ahead.
Yes, I do see it, said Basil. The only way of verifying the Operation Citadel intercepts is to have them discovered and transmitted quite innocent of any other influence by Stalin's most secret and trusted spy. That fellow has to come across them and get them to Moscow. And the route by which he encounters them must be unimpeachable, as it will be vigorously counterchecked by the NKVD. That is why the traitorous librarian at Cambridge cannot be arrested, and that is why no tricky subterfuge of cracking into the Cambridge Rare Books vault can be employed. The sanctity of the Cambridge copy of The Path to Jesus must be protected at all costs.
Exactly, Basil. Very good.
You have to get these intercepts to the spy. However, here's the rub. You have no idea who or where he is.
We know where he is, said the Admiral. The trouble is, it's not a small place. It's a good-sized village, in fact, or an industrial complex.
This Bletchley, whose name I was not supposed to hear, is that it?
Professor, perhaps you could explain it to Captain St. Florian?
Of course. Captain, as I spilled the beans before, I'll now spill some more. We have Jerry solved to a remarkable degree, via higher mathematical concepts as guidelines for the construction of electronic thinking machines, if you will.
Turing engines, they're called, said Sir Colin. Basil, you are honoured by hearing this from the prime mover himself. It's like a chat with God.
Please continue, your supreme beingness, said Basil.
Embarrassed, the professor seemed to lose his place, then came back to it.
Thinking machines that are able to function at high speed, test possibilities, and locate patterns which cut down on the possible combinations. I'll spare you details, but it's quite remarkable. However, one result of this breakthrough is that our location, Bletchley Park, about 50 kilometres out of London, an old Victorian estate in perfectly abominable taste, has grown from a small team operation into a huge bureaucracy. It now employs over 800 people gathered from all over the empire for their specific skills in extremely arcane subject matters. As a consequence, we have many streams of communication, many units, many subunits, many sub-subunits, many huts, temporary quarters, recreational facilities, kitchens, bathrooms, a complex social life complete with gossip, romance, scandal, treachery, and remorse. Our own slang, our own customs. Of course, the inhabitants are all very smart, and when they're not working they get bored and to amuse themselves conspire, plot, criticize, repeat, twist, engineer coups and counter-coups, all of which further muddies the water and makes any sort of objective truth impossible to verify. One of the people in this monstrous human beehive, we know for sure from the Finland Code, reports to Joseph Stalin. We have no idea who it is. It could be an Oxbridge genius, a lance corporal with Enfield standing guard, a lady mathematician from Australia, a telegraph operator, a translator from the old country, an American liaison, a Polish consultant, and on and on. I suppose it could even be me. All, of course, were vetted beforehand by our intelligence service, but he or she slipped by. So now it is important that we find him. It is in fact mandatory that we find him. A big security shakeout is no answer at all. Time-consuming, clumsy, prone to error, gossip, and resentment, as well as colossally interruptive and destructive to our actual task. But worst of all, a clear indicator to the NKVD that we know they've placed a bug in our rug. If that is the conclusion they reach, then Stalin will not trust us, will not fortify Kursk, etc., etc.
So breaking the code book is the key.
It is. I will leave it to historians to ponder the irony that in the most successful and sophisticated crypto-analytic operation in history, a simple book code stands between us and a desperately important goal. We are too busy for irony.
Basil responded. The problem then refines itself more acutely. It is that you have no practical access to the book upon which the code that contains the name for this chap's new handler is based.
That is it, in a nutshell, said Professor Turing.
A sticky wicket, I must say. But where on earth do I fit in? I don't see that there's any room for a boy of my most particular expertise. Am I supposed to, well, I cannot even conjure an end to that sentence. You have me.
He paused.
I think he's got it, said the Admiral.
Of course I have, said Basil. There has to be another book.